Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Economics, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Tim Jones, and my guests today are Professors Lisa Adkins and Martijn Konings to discuss The Asset Economy, their new book co-written with Professor Melinda Cooper, which will be published in December by Polity. At the heart of this short book is a single argument, quote, "The key element shaping inequality is no longer the employment relationship, but rather whether one is able to buy assets that appreciate at a faster rate than both inflation and wages," unquote. You may think you've heard something like this before, most notably in Thomas Piketty's 2014 blockbuster, Capital in the 21st Century. But today's authors add an important new twist. In the developed economies, and especially in Anglo-Saxon countries, the asset economy hasn't just widened inequalities and fed a creation of a super-rich rentier class. The authors claim that average households have actually turned Minskian. Quote, "People are increasingly living, managing, and planning asset-driven lives ordered by the speculative logics of asset appreciation," unquote. Lisa Adkins is the head of the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Sydney. She is an Academy of Finland Distinguished Professor and has held chairs in sociology at the University of Manchester and at Goldsmiths, London. Also at the University of Sydney, Martijn Konings is Professor of Political Economy and Social Theory. Lisa and Martijn, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tim. Nice to be here.
Now, you say in the introduction that the three of you had been working on similar themes in your research. How exactly did the book come together?
I think if I can go first here, like I think at the time I was working with Melinda Cooper on a number of projects, and we were both finishing up books that had overlapping themes. Lisa's previous book on The Time of Money was also very much on our radar because it was published in a series with Stanford that we edited. And we saw this kind of convergence of different problematics already revolving around how the logic of assets is reshaping how we think about modern society and the kind of inequalities that it produces. And I think we started off by inviting Lisa to work with us on a grant application. And from there, we started up a project at the University of Sydney. It's called The Asset Economy as well. And this was funded by the generously funded by the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences. And so the book became this centerpiece of that project. And I think that's how we got here.
And if I can just jump in, if I may, Tim. So we had these kind of books that were all pointing in the same direction and kind of revolving around asset price appreciation. And I think what distinguishes the kind of co-author book from our other three books independently written is the focus that we placed on asset price appreciation in relation to housing prices. So we became really interested in this simultaneous rise in housing prices and stagnating wages. And we became quite focused on the relationship between the two. And we were intrigued to kind of discover or to find out more about the institutional drivers. And living in Sydney, of course, was kind of perfect for us to think about this, in the sense that, like London, Sydney has had soaring house prices over a number of decades.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a thing a lot of people remember from the Piketty book was the notion that we had returned to the times of Jane Austen, you know, the idea that when who you married was more important than what you did. But what really jumps out to me in your book is the idea that the asset economy is much more dynamic than that. And I've picked out two money quotes, and I've got to say the book is full of them. It's a bit like a sort of economic Hamlet or something. So, quote, inheritance is no longer a simple transmission of property titles, but increasingly a strategically timed transfer of funds that need to be leveraged and put to work in the speculative logic of the asset economy. And the second one is, the asset economy requires not low commitment participation in trading, but investment and exposure, unquote. Did reaching this conclusion feel a bit like a eureka moment to you?
In some way, I guess a little bit. I think, I mean, perhaps to clarify, like I think we all fully accept the Piketty story as far as it goes. You know, there's a real return of, you know, we call it the 1% story, right? Like the extreme concentration of wealth at the very, very top. And I think that's totally happening. It's a real phenomenon. Where we felt a little that the Piketty story is incomplete is the fact that it cannot really explain why, you know, if these benefits go to so few people, why these policies have such longevity. And that's where we were really led to look at how these policies that lead to this concentration of wealth are really embedded in a much wider middle class politics that primarily centers on housing. And again, as Lisa just mentioned, this is so obvious in Sydney. Nobody who sort of lives a middle class life can really afford to ignore that. So that is where we became really interested in trying to resituate Piketty's conclusion and look at them through a slightly different lens. And that is also where when Piketty talks about things like inheritance, he very much sees it as a return to another time, like late 19th century plutocracy. And we're saying, yeah, that is partly what's going on, but what is much more interesting is what is happening, or what, you know, what is equally important and what you need to understand, that the wider configuration is really what is happening in the middle, where even regular people who would not necessarily even have grown up thinking about things like inheritance are now increasingly dependent, not so that they can live a rentier lifestyle at all, but just so they can get into the property market and participate in that sort of upward logic of property prices, which is no longer optional. It feels like, you know, you have to be in that, or you might very well fall by the wayside when it comes to achieving that middle class lifestyle. And then I think that part of that merging of, let's say, the old fashioned feudalism with the hyper speculative capitalism is what led us to thinking about the Minskian household. And I think Lisa will want to expand on that a little bit, probably.
Yeah, no, thanks, Martin. I mean, just to kind of underscore Martin's point. So if you look at wealth gains in the middle for households that are owning property across the kind of inflationary period in regard to house prices, you can see significant gains across the distribution. So not just at the very top. And of course, we're facing a different story now, because we're seeing lockout from the property market, but we can return to that issue. But on the Minskian household, so I mean, actually, Martin is an expert on Minsky as a financial economist. But what we argue in the book is that the dynamics of household has actually shifted significantly as a consequence of the asset economy. So now what defines or what's key for a household staying afloat is actually liquidity. So if we think about the household as we think about the household in the book as a balance sheet with assets and liabilities. And of course, the key for households for keeping themselves not just afloat, but making sure that they get a return on their investment in the future is being able to make regular payments on mortgages and so on. And the household then perfectly corresponds to the kind of balance sheet dynamics that Minsky described in terms of financial policymakers and so on. So we try in the book to reconceptualize how the household operates, which is in contrast to, for example, the story that we're so used to hearing from post-Keynesians, for example, that, you know, the households can't maintain such levels of debt and there will be a kind of tipping point where households will collapse and the property bubble will burst. And of course, we never see that point. Of course, some households do go under that are indebted, but the majority actually survive. And so our argument then is that what characterizes the current era is the Minskian household rather than, say, the Keynesian household.
Yeah, that was an interesting point. And is your argument there that the economic tipping point doesn't happen simply because the family unit itself is adapting? There's a sort of evolutionary adaptation into a more Minskian household. So if it looks as though a part of the younger generation will not be able to get hold of sufficient capital to put down a lump sum, other parts of the family will find it.
Is there a
natural adjustment mechanism there?
I wouldn't describe you as an, I mean, being social scientists, we're always a bit alarmed when we hear the word natural. I mean, 2 points. Yes, it's the kind of reproduction of class and for households to reproduce themselves through time, if you like, then intergenerational transfers have become critical. And as younger generations now find themselves locked out of the housing market because of rising house prices. But in regard to the first point, and tipping points, our argument actually is we can't find such objective tipping points precisely because of the speculative dynamics involved in households. So it's about the critical thing is not a tipping point or an amount of debt, but rather the maintenance of liquidity. So if you can't maintain liquidity, that's when a household won't survive.
And perhaps to just elaborate on that a little bit, I think that the idea of a tipping point is very associated with the notion that the property market works like any other market, so that if you inflate it to a certain extent, then at some point, you know, it will become apparent, the overvaluation will become apparent to everyone, and then the whole thing will collapse. And that is sort of the traditional reading of Minsky is very much about, you know, him being a critic of over indebtedness. And so we're trying to shift that and say, well, you know, there's no objective point of over indebtedness where the whole system will collapse. It all depends on how those liquidity flows are maintained or otherwise. So the property market is actually in some ways quite a transparent market in the sense that people know that, you know, these valuations are speculative. They're not, you know, people can see that. And yet it doesn't crash ever in the way that people projected will. And that has everything to do with the fact that it's not a regular market. It's not just governed by the free forces of supply and demand, but it is not just regulated, but it is propped up by any number of public policy measures that are designed to put a floor under the market. And that is not just in order to reward speculators, which, you know, like that might be the effect at times, of course, but it's the case because there is you know, there is this middle class, this broad-based middle class that has bought into this, and that, you know, governments are dependent on for their political support, and they cannot just afford to let these people go under. They cannot just afford to let them default on their mortgages. So, and in Australia, that is all very on the surface. That any number of policies that are specifically targeted at making sure that people can pay their mortgages, and the whole problem around quantitative easing and low interest rates sort of plays into that as well. But I think that is really the point we're making, that the sure, there may be overvaluation in some objective sense, but that's not the economics of that is not the end of it. You really need to look at why that is maintained and why public policy seems to be sort of locked in a certain pattern whereby it can only ever try to restart the market and maintain those valuations.
Yeah, in fact, you point out to those of us who don't live in Australia that that was a central point of the 2019 federal election, that the Labor Party was pushing some tax changes that were at least perceived to be a threat to property valuations and ended up losing. And we've all seen equivalent, we've seen equivalent things happen in the UK over the last couple of decades. If I had one frustration from reading your book, it was that there weren't explicit policy proposals in it. It was an analysis of a situation or a dynamic. Can you imagine a series of public policy proposals that would A, work, and B, people would vote for them?
Okay, sorry, I think Lisa and I are waiting for each other. She's going to take this question, but I'm happy to go first. I agree with you that I can relate to that being a frustrating feature of the book, because we had to, even during the writing, we wanted to sort of work towards something slightly more optimistic than we ended up with in a way. But we also felt that, you know, that kind of, I wouldn't call it pessimism, but that kind of realism without solutions, that does, I think, reflect, and the frustration that generates, I think that reflects something that is quite real, namely that we're in a situation where, I mean, I can think of any number of policies that would change the situation, or, you know, open up the market or do something to reduce the inegalitarian effects of the current situation. But to the extent that those policies would have that effect, they would also lose their political purchase. And so there's a really odd way in which public policy is catering to a gradually contracting middle class. And now there at some point may it be a tipping point, a political tipping point, where you can only, you know, afford to alienate so much of your constituency, and you can only see so many people drop out of that you know, aspiring middle class household existence without there being some pushback. But ultimately, I do think that the solution to this problem, or what will allow governments to break out of this policy lock-in, is political pressure, mobilization from below, or just the sheer, you know, a generation becoming so disaffected that it will become, that it will be seen as a problem. I don't think there are any great technical solutions that are waiting for us that will do the trick, because I think those things already would have been implemented.
Mm. Actually, on that point, you know, the idea of a rising millennial rebellion. I thought you addressed that very, very well, very interestingly. In this, you make the point that it's simplistic to see this as a generational combat, mm-hmm. and in fact, there are these, as you call them, intergenerational dynamics that determine not that people have access to wealth, but the different modes of access to the wealth. Could you elaborate on that point and why that's so important?
Yeah, I can have a go at that. And thanks for the question. I mean, I think what's become why this is so important is because intergenerational transfers and inheritance have become the key mechanisms through which the wealth base gains or wealth, the wealth effect can be passed on through to the next generation. So what we're seeing as a consequence is that kind of traditional class-based markers of class and socioeconomic positioning, for instance, occupation and so on, are becoming less and less important as this mechanism of intergenerational transfer and inheritance and basically wealth transfers are on the up, as it were. So what's so important about these transfers is, one, as we've already discussed, that they're not simply feudal-like, that they have this speculative dimension, but also that they're actually mechanisms of the reproduction of class and advantage. And are quite and are dividing the populations quite rigidly. So they're very decisive, as it were. And there's been quite a lot of research that's shown that even, I mean, in economics actually, that even small transfers of wealth intergenerationally make a huge difference in terms of wealth accumulation over time if the transfers are used for property purchases. Mm. So they're in essence, they're mechanisms that are creating wealth inequalities. So that's why they're so significant, I think. And we've actually just received some funding from the Australian Research Council to look into this, the qualitative aspects and the qualitative effects of transfers more systematically.
Yeah, and you also make this very nice point. I guess a lot of people, including me, tend to think of these generational transfers as something that happens at death, and that, you know, and that's something that can be addressed by public policy with inheritance tax and so on. But you make this point about this increasing amount of intergenerational wealth transfer, as you put it, inter vivos. So not just money going to younger people for lump sums on houses, but people taking on student loans, taking on past debts, funding unpaid internships and so on. It's, you know, so this is inheritance that actually happens during the lifetime of the benefactor. You have data on that, I think you have data on that for the UK. In the book, is it more widespread than that, or is this quite a, at the moment, is this quite a British thing?
Well, it's definitely a British thing. It's definitely an Australian thing as well. Yeah. So there's research that's shown that parents aren't just simply making clean transfers, either on death or during their lifetimes, but also releasing equity from their properties to be able to fund, for instance, as you say, internships and so on. And there are really distinctive innovations in the consumer mortgage products that are enabling intergenerational borrowing and capital flows. So it's quite extraordinary how these mechanisms are actually access to these transfers is actually determining life chances to a large extent. As you say, not just in regard to accessing property and the wealth effects of property, but also internships, which are increasingly necessary for professional jobs. And other kind of life opportunities.
Yeah, in the middle of the book, you actually provide a schema for a new way of thinking about social class, one where the main determinant is your standing in the asset economy. Could you try and talk us through this without the visual aid?
Sure. Should I have a go at that first of all? So I mean, in a way, what we've done there, it's a new class schema in which we try to represent how it's not relationships to jobs or occupation or education that determines one's socioeconomic standing. And that's the kind of standard or orthodox way that social scientists think about socioeconomic positioning or class or social stratification. And what we try to show in our schema is how its relationship to assets and especially to residential property, which is producing a stratified social structure. So in other words, it's changing the social structure. So the critical kind of threshold is whether one owns or doesn't own an asset. And of course, owning an asset can include owning while one is indebted, obviously. Yeah. So at the very top of the scheme, you'd find Piketty's 1%, the super rich, who have got portfolios of diversified assets. And then we've got two groups that we think Piketty and other people who are interested in the 1% tend to miss out, which is kind of, you know, as Martin's described them, the regular middle classes who might be outright homeowners with maybe an investment property or homeowners with mortgages. And again, they also might have investment properties as well. And then below the line, as it were, the other side of the threshold, we've got people with no housing assets, so renters who are locked out of asset ownership in the form of property, and also the homeless. So what we've tried to capture in our visualization is the ways in which its relationship to assets rather than to occupation or jobs that increasingly determines one's class position.
Have you had any pushback on this schema from other people in the field?
I think, definitely we've had some pushback in the sense that I think people read it quite literally, and that makes sense because we actually put it into a schema. So, you know, it's not, we can't really complain. But I think when people are presented with a classification like that, they do immediately respond by saying, well, you know, it is very obvious that for many, many people, employment and income from employment remains absolutely crucial. And that is, and we don't deny that at all. What we're saying is that income is less and less itself the basis of a middle-class lifestyle. And it's increasingly one of the factors, among others, that allows you to participate or not in this logic of the asset economy. So that's where we're trying to reframe the sources of inequality, not saying that, you know, like everything can be captured in this, but increasingly the logic of asset appreciation is shaping how social logics play out. And especially in Sydney, again, like, you know, like this is all very obvious. Like there's now such a, you know, widespread knowledge of the fact that, you know, so many renters, you know, still spend large amounts of money on their rent, but this is all going towards somebody else's mortgage. It's you know, that they're doing this to pay off somebody else's mortgage. An increasingly common phenomenon now is also middle-class people who make a decent amount of money, but not enough to be able to live, to buy a house where they want. So what they do is they rent somewhere, paying off somebody else's mortgage, while buying an investment property somewhere where they can afford it and renting that out so that somebody else is paying off that mortgage. So you end up with all these very strange, or you know, very strange, but like very unusual and unfamiliar situations that I think are really symptomatic of the way in which the social logic of inequality is shifting, and especially the fact that an average wage, you know, we used to think that, well, that allows you to sort of buy a house and have those things that make you sort of solidly middle class in both an economic and the cultural sense. And that situation is no longer there.
Okay, well, I have a final question. Now this book is out of the way, what are you both working on? Are you elaborating this further or working on something else entirely different?
We're definitely wanting to elaborate it further, and thanks for the question, Tim. I think I just mentioned that Martin and I, along with a colleague, Dallas Rogers, who's a housing studies scholar, we've just got a grant from the Australian Research Council to look at intergenerational transfers in further depth from a qualitative perspective. So we're going to look at how those intergenerational transfers may or may not make a difference to people in their life worlds. So we're looking really to really kind of get a further sociological grip on the kind of speculative aspects in particular of what kind of difference receiving a transfer really makes to people's lives. And especially including not only property ownership, but the other aspects that we've mentioned as well. So education, actually attending university, for example, and being able to pay off that debt, and also entering the labor market.
Yeah. And you make that very terrifying point about the enormous cost of a liberal arts education, particularly in the United States in that respect. Well, today I've been discussing the asset economy with two of its authors, Lisa Atkins and Martin Connings. The book will be published in December by Polity. Lisa and Martin, thank you very much for joining the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much, Tim.